Imagine this, okay. You've spent like the last 6 months of your life waking up way before dawn.
Oh yeah, just grueling work.
Right? You've poured every single ounce of your capital, your sweat, your sanity into growing 10,000 bushels of premium grain.
Just massive amounts of grain.
Exactly. It's finally harvested. It's sitting in your huge steel silos, practically turning to gold. And you are going to sell it next week and finally pay off those massive tractor loans.
The dream scenario.
But then, overnight, a geopolitical trade war erupts. Like, out of nowhere, a massive tariff drops the global price of grain by 40%.
Ouch. Yeah, that is brutal.
You are bankrupt before you even finish your morning coffee. Unless, and this is a big up, unless months ago you paid a tiny 20-cent fee for an absolute superpower.
And that superpower is exactly what we're getting into today.
Welcome to the deep dive. Oh, and by the way, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 3 course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted exactly like the real thing.
Yeah, it's a lifesaver. You can check it out at certfuel.com.
Definitely do that. All right, let's get right into the trenches here because we were looking at a terrifyingly large chunk of your Series 3 exam today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is the lion's share of the anxiety for most candidates, right?
Yeah.
If you're sitting for the Series 3, part one of this exam spans roughly 71% of the entire test.
Wait, 71% just across chapters 1 through 7?
Yep, chapters 1 through 7. And here's the kicker. The National Futures Association, the NFA, they don't even publish per unit weights.
Which means they don't give you like a neat little pie chart saying, spend exactly 10 hours on hedging and 2 hours on margin
No,
requirements.
they absolutely refuse to break it down.
Right. So because they won't give you that roadmap, you, the person listening to this right now, whether you're walking the dog or driving to work or just staring at a wall trying to force this stuff into your brain, you have to master absolutely everything we are about to cover.
There is no skipping this. None. You cannot just like skim the bold words in the textbook and hope you can guess your way through a multiple choice question.
No way. The math will totally expose you if you don't understand the underlying mechanics.
Exactly. You are jumping straight into the deep end, and you really need to know exactly how the water moves. Now, if you've been studying up to this point, you probably already know the basics of a futures contract.
Right. Like, that a futures contract locks in a price.
Yeah, it is a binding, rigid agreement. It's between a buyer and a seller to exchange a commodity at a future date, but for a price agreed upon today.
But today, our mission is different. We are moving way beyond the rigid lock of the futures contract.
We really are. Today, we're figuring out the why and the when of options.
Specifically, like, why and when would a hedger, a real-world business person, willingly choose to bleed cash out of their own pocket to pay an option premium?
Right, instead of just using a free futures contract, it's the ultimate question.
It really is the entire point of this unit. Why pay for something when a totally free alternative exists? And to get there, we're going to establish a core philosophy right off the bat.
This is crucial.
So if you have ADHD like me and your attention is starting to drift, rein it in right now. Seriously, snap back. Sear this into your brain. The guiding rule for this entire deep dive is this: an option protects the bad direction, it keeps the good direction, and the cost for this absolute superpower is the premium.
I love that. Protect the bad, keep the good, pay the premium.
Say it again so they hear it.
Protect the bad, keep the good, pay the premium. Everything we discussed today, all the complex T-charts, the tricky phrasing on the exam, those annoying intrinsic value calculations, all of it flows backward from that single fundamental truth.
I want you to think about your car insurance. Seriously, listener, visualize your actual car right now. You pay a premium to your insurance company every 6 months, right?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Let's say it's $1,000. Why do you do that? You do it so that if you hit a patch of black ice and wrap your car around a telephone pole, you're covered.
Your downside risk is totally protected.
Right. Now, let's look at the flip side. If you drive all year, the sun is shining, the roads are clear, and you don't crash, what happens?
Well, nothing happens.
Exactly. Do you sit on your couch, stare at your bank statement, and cry about losing that $1,000 premium? Do you say, "Oh man, I really wish I'd crashed my car today so I could get my money's worth out of Geico"?
Well, I mean, that would be a highly disturbed way to view the world.
Totally disturbed. You don't do that. You are thrilled you didn't crash. You accept that the $1,000 premium was just the sunk cost of peace of
The
mind.
premium is literally the cost of knowing you won't go bankrupt if the worst happens.
Exactly. While maintaining the absolute freedom to just drive your car normally on a beautiful day, I want you to keep that exact feeling in mind today.
That is such a critical psychological baseline to establish. In the financial markets, paying that premium is just a calculated business expense.
It's not a gamble at all.
Right. It is not a gamble. It is risk transfer. So let's take that concept and apply it to our first major scenario. We really need to dissect the seller's dilemma.
Let's make this super real. We're going to introduce a character. You are going to get very familiar with this guy, listener, so picture him clearly in your head. Let's call him Farmer Fred.
Farmer Fred. I like it.
Fred is a producer. He grows a massive amount of corn. He has huge steel silos on his property in Iowa, and right now, as we speak, they are filling up to the brim with physical corn.
Corn that he's going to sell in 3 months to pay his debts.
Exactly. But in the precise language of the Series 3 exam, we need to define Fred's economic position.
Yeah, the exam loves its terminology. Because Fred has the physical corn, or, you know, because he's already growing it and is guaranteed to possess it, the market says that Fred is long the cash.
Okay, let me pause you right there. Because long usually means you bought a stock and want it to go up. Why on earth do we call him long the cash commodity?
It's a great point. Long in the commodity world simply means you own the physical asset.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, if you are long something, you physically possess it, and therefore you benefit if its value increases. Fred has the corn. He is long the cash corn.
Got it.
But goes deeper than that. The exam will also expect you to know that Fred is long the basis.
Or whoa, you just dropped a major jargon bomb. Basis. I know for an absolute fact, the Series 3 beats candidates to death with basis questions.
They really do. It's everywhere.
Let's not gloss over this at all. What exactly is basis and why is Fred long it?
Okay, this is crucial. Basis is simply the difference between the local cash price of a commodity and the futures price of that same commodity.
So just the spread between the two.
Exactly. The formula is basis equals cash price minus futures price. It basically represents local supply and demand factors, storage costs, and transportation costs.
So let's put numbers on it. If the cash price of corn at Fred's local grain elevator is $6.20, but the futures contract expiring in 3 months is trading at $6 flat on the Chicago Board of Trade, the basis is positive 20 cents.
Correct. Now, why is Fred long the basis? Well, because he owns the physical crop, his ultimate profitability is tied directly to that local cash market.
Oh, because that's where he actually sells it.
Right. If the local cash price gets incredibly strong relative to the futures market, say, I don't know, a local ethanol plant opens up down the road and desperately needs corn, that basis might widen from positive 20 cents to positive 50 cents.
Which is great for him.
It's amazing for him. Because Fred owns the physical corn, a strengthening basis puts more money right in his pocket. So he is long the cash, and he is long the basis. He benefits when the local cash market is strong.
Okay, I have Fred's profile completely locked in. He's got the corn, he wants the local price to stay strong. But let me turn to you, the listener. Stop whatever you're doing for a second. Seriously, pause.
Pay attention to this.
If Fred has silos absolutely packed full of corn that he needs to sell later this year to pay the bank, what is his absolute worst nightmare? Give it a second. Think about the market.
Yeah, what is the one event that could bankrupt him?
Got it. It's a price drop. A massive sustained crash in the price of corn.
Yep.
If the price plummets between now and when he takes his trucks to the market, he is completely ruined.
Yep.
His revenue shrinks to nothing, but his costs, like the fertilizer, the diesel fuel, the tractor loans, those stayed exactly the same.
He is highly leveraged, usually. He desperately needs to hedge against a price drop.
So Fred opens his financial toolbox, and he sees two entirely different tools to protect himself from this nightmare scenario. Let's examine tool number one, the short futures hedge.
The classic hedge.
Okay, I'll take this one. The short futures hedge. Fred goes to his broker, and he sells futures contracts right now, today, matching the exact amount of corn he has in his silos. Let's say he sells them at $6 a bushel.
Okay, so he's short futures at six.
Right. This effectively locks his selling price in stone. If the cash price in the real world drops to $4, he is going to lose $2 on the physical corn. But his short futures position will gain $2, perfectly offsetting the loss.
He nets out at $6.
Exactly. He nets out at $6. And the best part, it costs him zero premium. There is no $1,000 car insurance bill.
It sounds totally perfect, right? Free protection. But the market never gives you something for nothing. There is a massive catch.
The catch is the trap of the locked door. What if there is a catastrophic drought in South America and global corn prices suddenly skyrocket?
Right. What if they shoot the moon?
What if the cash price shoots up to $9 a bushel? Fred is sitting there with his physical corn, practically salivating at the idea of selling it for $9, but he can't.
He can't because he is locked in.
He is trapped.
If he sells his physical corn for $9, his short futures position, the one he sold at $6, has now lost $3. $9 cash minus the $3 futures loss brings him right back to his locked-in price of $6.
He surrendered the favorable rise entirely. It's like an arranged marriage to a price. It is incredibly safe. You know exactly what you are getting. But there is absolutely zero upside, zero romance, zero chance for things to get unacceptably amazing.
No new trucks for Fred.
Exactly. He is stuck at $6 while his unhedged neighbors are buying shiny new trucks.
That cost-free certainty is the hallmark of the futures contract. You surrender the favorable move. Now let's look at tool number two, the tool we are really focusing on today, the long put option.
Tool number two, the long put.
Yes. Instead of locking himself into a binding futures contract, Fred can buy a put option. A put is the right, but absolutely not the obligation, to sell futures contracts at a specific strike price.
Okay, so it's a choice.
Right. Let's say he buys a put with a strike price of $6. Now, this is not free. This is the car insurance. This is going to cost him a premium up front. He has to write a check to his broker today. Let's say the premium is 20 cents a bushel.
He is bleeding cash today for the promise of protection tomorrow.
Exactly. He's paying for peace of mind.
Mm.
But look at what happens in that drought scenario. If prices skyrocket to $9 a bushel because of a global shortage, Fred is not trapped.
Because he doesn't have an obligation.
Right. He holds the right to sell at $6. But why on earth would he exercise that right when the market is offering him $9? He simply lets the put option expire in the trash can.
Just throws it away.
He takes his physical corn down to the local elevator, sells it for $9, and he is rich.
He kept the good direction. Protect the bad, keep the good, pay the premium. He paid the 20-cent premium, but he got to ride the rocket ship up to $9.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Mechanics are beautiful when you actually understand them. But before we get into the exact math of how we calculate his ultimate net price, we need to flash a giant flashing red warning light for the exam.
Oh, yeah. Let's call this exam trap alert number one, the wrong option. Listen to me very carefully right now.
This is a big one.
The exam writers are actively trying to trick your brain's natural associations. They will write a question that says something like, Farmer Fred fears a catastrophic price drop in the corn market. To protect himself against this declining market, which option should he buy?
And one of the answers will boldly say, buy a call.
And if you're rushing or if you're just memorizing flashcards without understanding the mechanics, your brain might think, oh, a call option. People buy calls when they want to go long. Long means good. Protection is good. He should buy a call.
Stop right there. Do not fall for it. It is entirely backwards.
Totally backwards.
You have to remember who Fred is in the physical real world. Fred is a seller of physical grain. He is drowning in corn. Therefore, to protect himself, he needs an instrument that gives him the right to sell in the financial market at a guaranteed price.
And what financial instrument gives you the right to sell? Give it a beat, a put.
Exactly, a put. A call option gives you the right to buy futures. Why in the world would Fred pay a premium for the right to buy more corn?
He already has silos full of this stuff.
He wants to get rid of it, not acquire more.
It defies all basic business logic. But the exam uses it constantly to weed out candidates who just don't understand the underlying business scenario. If you are a seller in the real world, you buy a put in the options world.
Keep it physical.
Yeah, I want you to visualize a farmer physically putting a bag of corn down on a table to sell it. He is putting it down. Seller equals put. Producer equals put.
So Fred buys a put. He secured the right to sell. Now, let's talk about what that put actually does for him mathematically on his balance sheet. It builds a floor.
Building the floor. I absolutely love this concept. Let's construct it. Fred is standing in a room, and the floor of that room represents the absolute minimum price he will ever accept for his crop.
Right. He wants to make sure that no matter how deep the economic depression gets, he never falls into the basement.
To calculate the exact level of that floor, the exact minimum net price Fred will walk away with, you use a very specific formula. If you are taking notes, write this down right now.
I get a pen.
The formula is effective floor equals the put strike price minus the premium paid.
Strike minus premium.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to play devil's advocate here because my ADHD brain hates this. Why are we subtracting? If the option is this amazing superpower that protects him, shouldn't it add to his wealth? Why wouldn't the premium add to his flow?
That's a very common confusion.
Oh.
I want you to stop thinking like a trader for a second and start thinking like a ruthless corporate accountant.
Okay, I have my visor on.
The premium is a business expense. It is cash that has permanently left Fred's checking account. Let's walk through the physical exchange of money. Imagine the market crashes, and Fred goes to the exchange and uses his put option to sell his corn for $6 a bushel. That $6 is his strike price. The clearinghouse hands him a crisp $6 bill.
Okay, he's holding $6?
Yes. But remember, 3 months ago, he wrote a check for 20 cents a bushel to buy that put option in the first place. Mm-hmm. He had to pay the insurance salesman.
Right, the premium.
So as an accountant, you have to take that 20 cent expense out of the $6 he just received. What is the actual net cash he gets to take home to his family and use to pay off his tractor loan?
$6 minus 20 cents. He actually takes home $5.80.
Exactly. The $6 is his gross revenue, but the $5.80 is his net price. It is his take-home pay. The premium is a drag on his final profitability.
It's a literal cost.
It is a cost that reduces the amount of money he actually keeps in his pocket. Therefore, you must subtract it from the strike price to find his true effective floor. The absolute worst he will ever do is $5.80.
Which brings us directly to exam trap alert number two, the plus-minus trap. The exam writers are incredibly sneaky with this.
Oh, they love this one.
They know that under the stress of the ticking clock, your brain might just guess the mathematical operation. They will give you a word problem like, Fred buys a $6 strike put for a 20 cent premium, and I guarantee you answer choice A will be $6.20.
They will inflate the floor by adding the premium, trying to lure you into the psychological trap of thinking that the option magically makes Fred richer.
But it doesn't.
It doesn't. It's an insurance expense. For a seller, to find the effective floor, you always, always subtract the premium. Strike minus premium equals the floor.
Strike minus premium equals the floor. Seriously, write it on your hand. Okay, we have the theory. We have the traps. Now we're moving into the meat of this. We're going to stress test Farmer Fred's floor under extreme condition.
This is where we prove it works.
We are going to run the agonizing step-by-step numbers, and I need you, the listener, to follow along with the math. Do not zone out here. The exam will ask you to calculate the final net result after a market move, and you need to know exactly how to build the T-chart.
This step-by-step breakdown is vital. It is how you prove to yourself that the formula actually works in practice. It's the only way you're going to remember it on test day. Let's set up the exact scenario.
Let's do it.
It's planting season. The current futures market for corn is trading at exactly $6 or 6.00 per bushel.
The board says 6,000. Got it.
Fred is nervous about a massive oversupply this year, so he decides to hedge. He buys a put option. Specifically, he buys a 6.0 strike put. For that privilege, he pays a premium of 0.00 per bushel to a speculator on the other side of the trade.
Okay, before we even look at what the weather does or what the market does, listener, what is his floor? Do the math in your head right now. Strike minus premium, $6 minus 20 cents.
His effective floor is 5.80. He knows, absolutely knows, that regardless of what happens, he will never walk away with a net price of less than 5.8 per bushel.
All right, let's hit him with a catastrophe. Scenario A, the nightmare.
Bring it on.
It is harvest time, and the weather was absolutely perfect everywhere in the world. There is a massive, unprecedented glut of corn. Nobody wants it. The silos are overflowing. The cash price crashes all the way down to 5.40 a bushel. Fred is standing at the local elevator looking at the board, and the cash price is 5.40.
If Fred were unhedged, he would be physically ill right now. He budgeted for $6, and he's looking at 5.40. He's facing bankruptcy. But he is not unhedged. He has his put. So let's build the T-chart. You always need two columns, the cash market side and the option side.
Let's do the cash side first.
Fred is a farmer. He has to get rid of the physical corn. It'll rot if he doesn't. So he sells his physical corn in the local cash market for whatever the going rate is. Today, that is 5.40. That goes in the plus column on the cash side. He took in 5.40.
Okay, he's got 5.40 in his pocket. It feels terrible. But wait, we have to look at the option side of the T-chart. He holds that 6.00 strike put.
Exactly. And because the market price dropped to 5.40, the right to sell at 6.0 is highly, highly valuable.
Oh, yeah, huge value.
Think about it. The market is only paying 5.40, but Fred holds a legal contract allowing him to sell at 6.0. That contract has what we call intrinsic value. The put is intrinsically worth exactly 60 cents, 0.60.
So how does he realize that value? Does he actually deliver corn through the futures market?
Usually no. Delivering physical commodities against a futures contract is complicated and really expensive. Instead, Fred simply sells his put option back to the market. He offsets his position. He bought it for 20 cents months ago, and today he sells it for 60 cents. He gains 0.60 on the options trade.
So let's tally this up. T-chart time. On the physical side, he got 5.40 from the local grain buyer. On the financial side, he got 0.60 in pure profit from his put option offsetting. 5.40 plus 0.60 equals a gross revenue of exactly 6.0.
But we aren't done. The accountant is knocking on the door again. We have to account for the original sunk cost of doing business. Months ago, he paid that 0.20 premium to buy the option in the first place. We must subtract that 0.20 expense from his 6.0 gross revenue.
$6 gross minus the 20 cent premium expense, 5.80.
5.8. His net realized price is 5.80. The floor held. Look at that.
Yeah.
Even though the real world market crashed to 5.40, Fred walked away with exactly 5.80. The math works perfectly.
The floor actually held. It is a mathematical certainty. He is standing on solid ground at 5.80 while the unhedged farmers down the road are falling into the basement at 5.40. He survived the nightmare.
He survived because he transferred the risk to the speculator who sold him that put. The speculator lost that 60 cents, but hey, that's their problem. Fred is safe.
Okay, let's look at the boundary conditions. What if the market doesn't crash all the way to 5.4? What if the market drops to exactly 5.8?
Let's run it. Cash price is 5.88. Fred sells his physical corn for 5.80. Now look at his 6.00 strike put. It has an intrinsic value of 20 cents because 6.00 minus 5.88 is 0.20. So he sells the option back for 0.20.
Gross revenue matches 5.80 plus 0.20 option gain equals 6.00. Subtract the original 0.20 premium he paid. 6.00 minus 0.20 equals 5.8.
Exactly. It doesn't matter if the market drops to 5.80, 5.4, or goes all the way to absolute zero. The floor is absolute.
Okay, I am thoroughly convinced the floor works. But now let's completely flip the script. Let's look at scenario B, the dream. We have the same initial setup. The floor is established at 5.88. But this time, the weather doesn't cooperate. There is a massive drought in South America. There is a global shortage of corn. The cash price shoots up like a rocket to 650.
So Fred takes his physical corn down to the local elevator, and the buyer is desperate. He sells it for 650. He takes in 650 on the physical side of the T-chart.
Okay, but wait a minute. Stop everything. Let me look at the option side of the chart. If the market is at 650, nobody in their right mind wants to exercise an option that forces them to sell at 6.0.
Definitely not.
That would be voluntarily losing 50 cents a bushel. That put option has zero intrinsic value. It is totally, completely useless. He just lost his 20 cent premium. Isn't that a terrible thing? Didn't he just set fire to a pile of cash?
This reaction right here, this is exactly where intelligent people get tripped up. Exam trap alert number 3. The worthless expiration fallacy.
Because it hurts.
It feels viscerally bad to let a financial instrument expire worthless, right? It feels like you made a massive mistake. You wasted money. But I want to calmly explain why this is actually the absolute best possible outcome for Farmer Fred.
I am extremely skeptical, convince me. Because right now, I'm mourning that 20 cents. It feels like a bad trade.
I need you to go back to the car insurance. Letting the option expire worthless is the exact financial equivalent of not crashing your car. Yes, you paid the $1,000 car insurance premium, but you didn't need the insurance payout because nothing bad happens.
Right.
The sun was shining. The market rallied. Let's run the cold, hard math on the dream scenario.
Okay, let's do the T-chart.
Fred sells his cash corn at the current booming market price of 6.50. He's thrilled about that. Hmm. Now, his put option is out of the money. It expires entirely worthless. He gets $0 out of it.
So his gross revenue is 6.50.
Correct. But the accountant is still there. We still have to subtract the 0.20 premium he originally paid months ago. It is a sunk cost.
6.50 gross minus 0.20 sunk premium cost is a net of 6.30.
Exactly. His final net price is 6.3. Now, I want you to compare that to his floor. His protected floor was 5.80. He is vastly, vastly richer than his floor. He is 50 cents richer per bushel. The worthless expiration of the option is simply the cost of doing business in a booming, highly profitable market.
Wow. He gladly paid 20 cents to have the privilege of making 6.30 instead of being locked into a rigid short futures hedge at 6.0.
Let me process that for a second. If he had used a short futures hedge back at the beginning, he would have sold his physical corn at $6.50, but his short futures position would have lost 50 cents, bringing his net right back down to 6.0. He would have missed the entire rally.
He would have missed all of it.
But because he used the option, he nets 6.30.
Right. He captured 30 cents of the 50 cent rally after paying his insurance cost. So if we want to summarize Fred's existence in a single sentence, it is this. The put option helps him, the only net of the premium.
Right.
In a rising market, Fred will always be exactly 20 cents poorer than the raw cash price. Mm. But in a falling market, his downside floor is absolutely mathematically bulletproof.
Protect the bad, keep the good, pay the premium. He paid the 20 cents, he kept the good rise all the way up to 6.30, and if it had gone bad, he was protected at 5.80. The philosophy holds up under extreme pressure. And this is the exact logical process you must repeat on the exam. Do not try to hold these moving parts in your head.
Oh, please don't.
The moment you see a question about a farmer or a producer or a seller, grab your scratch paper. Draw a T-chart. Write down the cash sale on the left. Write down the option gain or loss on the right. Subtract the premium. It will save you from careless errors every single time.
Absolutely. The scratch paper is your best friend. All right, I think we have successfully saved Farmer Fred's farm. The silos are empty, he has his cash, he paid off the tractors, he is happy. But the supply chain doesn't stop at the silo. We have to follow the corn. Somebody had to buy all those thousands of bushels from Fred.
Which brings us to the other side of the coin, the buyer's burden.
Let's introduce our second recurring character. Meet Processor Pete.
Processor Pete.
Pete owns a manufacturing plant. He makes highly specialized organic animal feed. Let's say it's premium feed for extremely pampered show alpacas.
That is a very niche, very strange market.
Very niche, but incredibly high margins. The alpaca breeders will pay top dollar for this feed. But Pete has a massive structural problem in his business model. He is a buyer. He is a processor. He does not grow corn.
Right.
He does not have the physical grain right now. He needs to acquire it to run his factory.
So we define Pete's economic position in the exact opposite way we define Fred's. The exam will state that Pete is short the cash.
Okay, let's define that clearly. Remember earlier when we said Fred was long the cash because he physically possessed the stuff?
Yep.
Pete is short the cash because he lacks the physical stuff. He is naked in the real world. He has a factory that requires corn, but he has zero corn. He is structurally forced to go out into the market and buy it later.
That is exactly right. Being short the cash means you are economically committed to buying the physical commodity in the future. Now, we also have to talk about his basis risk. Pete is short the basis.
Walk me through that. Why is he short the basis?
Remember, the formula basis equals cash minus futures. Pete has to buy in the local cash market. He wants the local cash price to be as cheap as possible. If the local basis weakens, meaning the cash price drops significantly relative to futures, maybe because a new local farm just dumped a huge supply, Pete is thrilled.
Because he buys it cheap.
He gets to buy cheap. He benefits from a weakening basis. Therefore, he is short the basis.
Okay, listener, I'm tapping you in again. Flip your brain entirely. Wipe Fred from your memory for a second. We spent the last 30 minutes sweating over prices dropping. But if Pete needs to buy thousands of bushels of raw materials next month to keep his alpaca feed factory running, what keeps him awake at night in a cold sweat? Give it a beat.
What ruins a buyer? Think about it.
A price spike. A massive, terrifying price spike. If the price of corn triples because of that South American drought, Pete's input costs skyrocket. He can't instantly raise the price of his alpaca feed by 300%. His customers would totally revolt.
They'd take their alpacas somewhere else.
Exactly. His profit margins vanish instantly, and he might have to shut down the factory and lay off his workers.
It is an existential threat. So Pete needs tools to protect against a rising market. And just like Fred, Pete has two distinct tools in his financial toolbox. Tool number one, the long futures hedge.
Let's examine the long futures hedge for a buyer. Pete calls his broker and buys futures contracts today. This locks in his future purchase price. Just like Fred's short hedge locked his selling price, Pete's long hedge locks his buying price at, say, $6. It costs zero premium. It is incredibly safe.
There's always a but with the rigid futures contract.
But what if prices plummet? What if that massive glut of corn hits the market and physical cash corn is trading for practically nothing? Let's say $3 a bushel. Pete is walking past the local grain elevator looking at a bargain bin of $3 corn, and he's not allowed to buy it at that net price.
He is not allowed because he is locked in. If he buys the physical corn at $3, his long futures position, which he bought at $6, has lost $3. $3 cash cost plus a $3 futures loss means his net cost is dragged right back up to $6.
Ouch.
The favorable fall in price is completely 100% surrendered.
That has to hurt. He is watching his unhedged competitors buy dirt cheap corn and expand their market share while he is stuck paying double.
It hurts deeply, which is exactly why corporate buyers and processors like Pete often prefer tool number two, the long call option.
Ah, the long call. Superpower for the buyer.
Yes. A long call gives Pete the right, but absolutely not the obligation, to buy futures contracts at a specific strike price. Mm-hmm. Now, he has to pay a premium up front for this right. But if cash prices crash to $3, Pete doesn't have to exercise his option. He just lets it expire, walks right up to that bargain bin in the cash market, and buys the incredibly cheap grain.
He keeps the good direction. Protect the bad price spike. Keep the good price crash. Pay the premium. It is the exact mirror image of Farmer Fred.
It is a perfect mirror image, which leads us directly into the jaws of exam trap alert number four, flipping the hedger.
This is where they catch 50% of the people taking the test.
They absolutely do. The exam writers will test your muscle memory. They know that earlier in your studies, you learned that puts are used for protection by stock investors. So they will give you a buyer, like Processor Pete, who desperately fears a price rise, and they will suggest that he buys a put option to protect himself.
Because the word put just sounds protective. I'm putting a stop to this.
Exactly. It's a psychological trick. But you have to think mechanically about the real-world business. Pete is a buyer. He's going to be buying physical grain. Therefore, he needs a financial instrument that gives him the right to buy at a guaranteed price. And what instrument gives you the right to buy? A call.
Buyer equals call. Say it out loud right now, listener, wherever you are. Buyer equals call. Seller equals put. Buyer equals call. Never, ever mix those up. A put would give Pete the right to sell futures. Why on earth would he want to sell futures? He has no corn.
He needs to acquire.
It makes zero sense. A call option gains intrinsic value as prices rise, and that financial gain is exactly what Pete needs to offset his soaring physical cash costs at the feed factory.
Perfectly reasoned. So Pete buys a call. He has secured the right to buy. Now we need to figure out what that call mathematically does to his balance sheet. With Fred the seller, we built a floor to protect him from falling into the basement. With Pete the buyer, we are building a ceiling.
Building the ceiling. He wants to make sure his costs never go through the roof. Let's do the math.
The formula for Pete is effective ceiling equals the call strike price, PLUS, the premium paid.
Okay, I am going to stop you and demand a visual here, because earlier with Fred, we subtracted the premium and now we are adding it, and I can already feel a test taker's brain threatening to mix these two operations up under pressure. Why are we adding?
Let's create a very clear, grounded metaphor. Do not think about building materials. Think about buying a car. Imagine Pete goes to a dealership to buy a delivery truck for his factory. The strike price of his call option represents the sticker price on the windshield of that truck. Let's say it says $40,000. That is the base, agreed upon price of the asset.
Okay, I see the sticker price, $40,000.
But Pete cannot just write a check for $40,000 and drive away. The dealership has a mandatory, non-negotiable dealership fee of $3,000. That fee represents our options premium. To find out his true, absolute maximum out-of-pocket cost to acquire that truck, what does he have to do?
He has to add them together. He pays the $40,000 sticker price, PLUS, the $3,000 mandatory fee. His total maximum cost is $43,000.
Exactly. Pete has to pay for the raw cost of the corn at the strike price. AD, he has already paid the premium to the options market. It is an added cost on top of his purchase. If his call guarantees he can buy corn for $4, but he had to pay 30 cents to buy the call option, his total, absolute maximum out-of-pocket expense to acquire that corn is $4.30.
He is a buyer, so everything he pays out is an expense that adds to his total burden.
Ah, that makes so much sense when you frame it like the dealership fee. Let's contrast that. Fred was a seller. He was receiving money, so the premium eat into his profits, making his floor lower subtraction. Pete is a buyer. He is spending money. So the premium adds to his expenses, making his ceiling higher addition.
You've got it. Strike PLUS premium equals the ceiling for a buyer.
This is so crucial, it hurts. Listener, if you are taking notes, divide a page in half. On the left side, write seller put floor subtract. On the right side, write buyer call ceiling at. Burn that into your retinas. Now that we have the ceiling built, we are going to stress test Processor Pete's ceiling. We're going to run the agonizing step-by-step numbers again, because repetition and varied scenarios are how this gets permanently lodged in your long-term memory.
Let's set the stage. The market for corn is currently trading at exactly 4.00 per bushel.
4.00 flat.
Pete is terrified about a potential price spike, so he decides to hedge. He buys a 4.00 strike call option. The premium for this call is 130 per bushel.
All right, listener, I want you to do the math before we say it out loud. What is his effective ceiling? What is his absolute maximum net cost per bushel?
Think about the dealership fee. Strike plus premium.
4.0 strike plus the 0.30 premium equals a ceiling of 4.30. Pete knows with absolute mathematical certainty that no matter what happens in global politics, weather, or supply chains, he will never pay more than 4.30 per bushel net for his corn.
Okay, let's hit him with scenario A, the nightmare. The South American drought is worse than expected. The alpacas are hungry. Global corn prices spike violently to 4.60 a bushel. Pete has to go into the local cash market and buy physical corn at 4.60. He is writing massive checks.
But he shouldn't be sweating because he has his call option. Let's look at the T-chart for the buyer. It works a little differently because he is spending money, not receiving it. On the physical cash side, he buys the grain for 4.60. That is a cost of 4.60.
Okay, cost of 4.60 on the left.
So look at the option side of the chart. He owns a 4.0 strike call, and the market is currently at 4.6. That option is deep in the money. It gives him the right to buy at 4.00 something that is currently worth 4.60. It has an intrinsic value of exactly 60 cents, or 0.60. So he sells the call option back at the market and realizes a 0.60 profit.
So he uses that financial gain to offset his massive physical cost. Let's do the arithmetic. He paid 4.60 for the physical grain, but he made 0.60 by selling his call option. 4.60 cost minus the 0.60 financial gain brings his raw offset cost back down to exactly 4.00.
Right. But the accountant is back. We can't forget the dealership fee. We have to add the 0.30 sunk premium he paid up front months ago.
So 4.00 raw offset cost. PLUS, the 0.30 premium expense, is 4.3.
Total net cost, 4.30. The ceiling held. Even though the real-world market raged all the way up to 4.60, Pete's total net out-of-pocket cost was strictly capped at 4.3.
The roof did not blow off the factory. He is safe. The alpacas get fed, and Pete stays in business. Okay, let's test scenario B, the dream. This is where it gets really interesting. Same initial setup. The ceiling is locked at 4.30. But this time, the drought never happens. There is a record harvest. Prices crash down to 3.7 a bushel.
Okay, listener, you tell me. The current cash price of corn is 3.70. Pete is holding a call option in his hand that gives him the right to buy corn at 4.0. Does he exercise it?
Give him a beat to think about it.
Absolutely not.
Why in the world would he demand to pay 4.0 when the market is eagerly offering it to him for 3.70? That would be financial suicide. He throws the option in the trash. He lets it expire.
Let's mathematically analyze this dream scenario. Pete buys the physical grain in the cheap flooded cash market at 3.70. His 4.00 call option is out of the money, so it expires worthless. This means he simply loses his 0.30 premium. It's a sunk cost with no payout. So what is his total net cost?
He paid 3.70 for the physical grain, PLUS, the 0.30 he already spent on the expired insurance policy.
Yeah.
3.70 plus 0.30 is a net cost of exactly 4.0.
Net cost 4.00. Now compare that to his absolute ceiling of 4.30. He is thrilled. He just saved 30 cents a bushel off his maximum budget. This is the one-sided benefit we've been talking about. But wait.
I know exactly what you're going to say. I'm looking at these numbers and I'm seeing a potential flaw in the options are always better narrative.
Let's hear it. What are you seeing?
Let's compare Pete's option strategy to what would have happened if he used a long futures hedge. If he had used a long futures contract, he would have locked in his price at 4.00 flat, right?
Correct. No premium.
Okay, so if the market crashes to 3.70, the futures guy buys cash at 3.70, but his futures contract loses 0.30, so his net cost is 4.0.
Yes, that's right.
But Pete, using the option, bought cash at 3.70, added his 0.30 premium, and his net cost is, illeso, 4.00. They're exactly the same. In this specific scenario, the option didn't give Pete any advantage over the futures contract. He paid a premium for nothing.
You caught it. This is a highly nuanced point, and it is a level of understanding that separates the candidates who barely pass from the candidates who truly master the material. There is a specific price point where the futures contract and the option contract provide the exact same net result. The option does not magically make you richer in every single downside scenario.
Okay, so prove to me why Pete bothered to pay the premium. If it netted out the same at 3.70, why use the option?
Because the true advantage of the option doesn't reveal itself until prices fall drastically further. 3.70 is just the breaking point between the two strategies. Let's push the market further. Let's say there's a catastrophic oversupply and prices crash all the way down to 3.0 bushel.
Okay, let's run the race at 3.0.
Let's look at the futures hedger first. The guy who locked in at 4.0. The cash market crashes to 3.0. He buys physical corn at 3.0. But his long futures position, which is locked at 4.0, has lost a massive 1.00. So his 3.00 cash cost POS, his 1.0 futures loss equals a net cost of 4.0. He is permanently stuck paying 4.0, even though the world is practically giving corn away.
Ouch. Yeah, that hurts. Now let's look at Pete with his option hedge.
Prices crash to 3.00. Pete buys the physical cash corn at the incredibly cheap price of 3.0. His 4.0 call option expires worthless, so he just adds his sunk 0.30 premium. His 3.0 cash cost POS, his 0.30 premium expense equals a total net cost of 3.30.
Boom. There it is. The futures guy is stuck paying 4.0. Pete is paying 3.30. Pete is saving 70 cents a bushel over his competitor. He's crushing the competition because his downside cost was allowed to keep falling, minus the cost of the premium.
That is the immense power of keeping the favorable move. The option allows you to participate in extreme favorable market swings that a futures contract completely cuts you off from.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. The option is built for extreme moves. But before we get too swept up in celebrating Pete's victory, we must address exam trap alert number five, subtracting the premium for a buyer.
We talked about this a bit with the car dealership fee, but we need to hammer it home for the perspective of how the test will actually try to fail you.
The test writers are evil. They will give you Pete's exact scenario, a 4.00 call strike and a 0.30 premium, and they will ask for the effective ceiling. And I guarantee you, answer choice A will be 3.70.
Because they are hoping you just blindly remember Farmer Fred's subtraction rule and you subtract the 0.30 from the 4.0.
If you subtract the premium from a call strike for a buyer, you are massively understating their true maximum cost. You are tricking yourself into thinking the insurance policy acted as a coupon that made things cheaper. Insurance is never a discount. Insurance is an added cost on top of your baseline risk.
Always, always ADD the premium for a buyer. Ceiling equals strike PLUS premium. Do not let them steal a point from you on something so mechanical.
Okay, we have dug incredibly deep into the micro mechanics of both Fred the seller and Pete the buyer. We've done the math upside down and backward, but now we really need to pull back and look at the macro picture. We are moving into the side-by-side showdown, futures versus options. Why do these two parallel markets even exist?
This is where we synthesize everything. If you are a visual learner, imagine a whiteboard with a line drawn down the middle, two columns. On the left side, we write futures hedge. On the right side, we write option hedge. Let's do a direct mirror image comparison of the fundamental traits of these two strategies.
Okay, let's start with the futures hedge column on the left. Let's sum it up. What does it do?
A futures hedge locks the price both ways. It completely eliminates your downside risk, but it simultaneously eliminates your upside potential. What is the explicit cost? The premium is zero. What happens to a favorable price move? It is completely surrendered. You are locked in a box.
Locked both ways. Zero premium. Surrenders the good stuff.
Got it. Now let's look at the option hedge column on the right. An option hedge protects one way. It sets a floor for a seller or a ceiling for a buyer. What is the explicit cost? The cost is the premium paid in cash upfront. What happens to a favorable price move? It is capped, net of that premium. You are protected from the worst, but free to enjoy the best.
Protects one way, costs a cash premium, keeps the good stuff.
Okay, I am going to push back here. I am putting myself in the shoes of a listener who is actually thinking about starting their own physical commodity business, maybe buying a farm or opening a processing plant. I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, if options are so unbelievably great, if they let you keep all the good moves and just cap the bad ones, why wouldn't Fred and Pete just use options 100% of the time? Why do futures even exist? Are futures just for cheapskates who refuse to pay a premium? That is a fantastic real-world question. And honestly, it represents a fundamental misunderstanding of corporate risk management to think that one tool is universally better than the other. The decision between futures and options is a complex trade-off regarding cash flow, margin requirements, and institutional risk tolerance.
Yeah.
It is not a matter of right or wrong.
Elaborate on that. Because on paper, the option looks vastly superior. Why would someone intentionally choose the rigid, suffocating lock of a futures contract over the flexible protection of an option?
It almost entirely comes down to cash flow and credit risk. Let's think about Farmer Fred's actual life. Let's say he is deeply, dangerously in debt. He just bought 3 brand new $500,000 John Deere tractors, and his operating loans are maxed out.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, the local bank manager is sitting across from him with a clipboard, and the bank needs to see guaranteed absolute certainty on Fred's revenue projections for the harvest, or they're going to foreclose on his farm today.
The bank doesn't care about his upside potential at all. They just want their money.
Exactly. Fred does not have the luxury of hoping for a price rally. He cannot afford to pay a 20-cent premium in cash right now because his bank account is empty. He needs cost-free certainty immediately.
So he uses the futures.
So he uses a short futures hedge to absolutely lock in his price at $6. He takes that locked futures contract to the bank manager, slaps it on the desk, and says, "Look, my revenue is mathematically guaranteed by the exchange. Do not foreclose."
No.
He willingly sacrifices the potential upside to guarantee his immediate survival.
And crucially, he didn't have to drain his severely limited cash reserves to pay an options premium up front. He got the protection for free at the cost of his future flexibility.
Right. Now contrast that with processor Pete. Let's say Pete is not a small business owner. Let's say Pete is the chief risk officer for a massive, multinational, well-capitalized agricultural corporation.
They've got deep pockets.
They have billions in cash reserves. They can easily afford to write a check for a massive option premium. They are more than willing to pay cash up front to keep an open ceiling for their buyers. Why? Because they want to participate in favorable market swings. That flexibility is how they generate alpha, how they outmaneuver smaller competitors who are locked into rigid futures contracts.
So it's heavily dependent on your financial padding. If you are scraping by, heavily leveraged, and need absolute ironclad certainty to satisfy a lender, you lock it in with futures for free. If you have the deep pockets and the cash flow to buy a safety net while still aggressively reaching for the stars, you buy the option.
That is the perfect synthesis. The tool you choose depends on the specific financial health of your balance sheet, which brings us to our final and perhaps most insidious trap. Exam trap alert number 6, the cost myth.
Let me guess. The exam tries to make options sound like a magical free lunch.
Exactly. The exam writers will present a question evaluating the benefits of an option over a futures contract. And they will try to trick you by offering an answer choice that says something like, "The primary advantage of an option hedge over a futures hedge is that it is cost-free."
No way.
Or they might try a different angle and say, "An option is superior because it locks the price both ways, like a futures contract, but with more flexibility."
I am vehemently shaking my head right now.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
No to all of that.
The singular advantage of the option is keeping the favorable direction. That is its one and only superpower. The disadvantage is the premium cost. Options are absolutely not cost-free, and they absolutely do not lock the price both ways. If you see an answer choice claiming an option is free, or that it locks both upside and downside, eliminate it immediately. It is a lie designed to test your core understanding.
It is one-sided insurance. You pay cash for it. End of story. Okay, this has been an incredibly intense, dense journey. We have built floors out of strike prices. We have stacked mandatory dealership fees on top of ceilings. We've analyzed the psychology of leveraged farmers, and we've navigated 6 different traps that the exam writers have laid out for you. Now, we are going to lock this in.
Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute most highly testable takeaways from everything we've just discussed. If you only remember 4 things from this hour, make it these 4 points.
Rapid fire. I'll read the scenario, you give the rule. Number 1, the seller.
A seller, like a farmer or producer, fears a price drop. They use a long put to establish a protective floor. The mathematical formula is strike minus premium. This strategy allows them to keep the upside benefit of a rising market.
Number 2, the buyer.
A buyer, like a processor or manufacturer, fears a price rise. They use a long call to establish protective ceiling. The mathematical formula is strike PLUS premium. This strategy allows them to keep the downside benefit of a falling market.
Number 3, the core difference, futures versus options.
Futures contracts lock the price strictly both ways for 0 premium, completely surrendering any favorable market move. Options protect only one way, cost a cash premium up front, and allow the hedger to keep the favorable market move.
Number 4, the paradox of the worthless option.
An expired, completely worthless option is actually a good thing for a hedger. It means the real-world cash market moved significantly in their favor, and they were able to take full advantage of it. The lost premium is simply the accepted sunk cost of having that flexibility. It is the uncrashed car.
That recap is pure concentrated test prep. Listen to those 4 points on a loop if you have to. Write them on sticky notes, put them on your bathroom mirror. Now, before we sign off, I want to leave you with something to chew on, something that goes beyond the clean textbook formulas we've been drilling and looks at how this actually functions in the chaotic reality of the global markets.
Yes. Let's leave them with a final provocative thought regarding market mechanics.
We have spent this entire deep dive perfectly calculating ceilings and floors, assuming you simply look up the premium on a screen, write a check for 20 cents, and move on with your life. But who is deciding that the premium is 20 cents? And what happens to these perfect hedging strategies if market volatility absolutely explodes?
That is the real-world terror that keeps chief risk officers awake at night. The textbook assumes premiums are static. They are not.
Imagine a massive, unprecedented global crisis. Let's say a major war breaks out in a region that produces a huge percentage of the world's grain. The supply chain is completely shattered. Grain prices aren't just moving a few cents. They're swinging wildly, limit up 20% one day, limit down 20% the next. Just complete chaos.
In that environment, the people selling the options, the market makers, the speculators taking the other side of Fred and Pete's trades, they panic.
Because their risk of having to pay out on those options is suddenly enormous. They are staring down the barrel of massive losses. So what do? They dramatically, violently increase the cost of the premiums they charge.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the equivalent of a homeowner's insurance company aggressively raising the rates on flood insurance while a Category 5 hurricane is actively barreling toward the coast. The risk is immense. So the price of protection skyrockets.
So suddenly, that manageable 20-cent premium that Fred budgeted for jumps to $1 a bushel, or $1.50.
It fundamentally changes the entire math equation of the business.
It totally destroys the equation. Think about Fred's floor formula, strike minus premium. If he buys a $6 put, but the premium is now $1.50 because of extreme volatility, his floor is 4.50. He's paying a fortune just to guarantee a terrible price. If the premium itself suddenly costs more than the entire expected profit margin on the crop, what do you do as a business owner?
That is the breaking point.
At what point is the insurance simply too mathematically expensive to buy? At what point does an option stop being a protective financial tool and start being a mathematical guarantee that you will lock in a loss?
That is the exact line where even the most aggressive, well-capitalized corporate hedger is forced to abandon the luxury of options. They are forced to return to the rigid, free, stifling safety of a futures contract. Or, in extreme cases, they simply choose not to produce the commodity at all that year because the risk cannot be economically managed. It is a fascinating, terrifying dynamic that proves these markets are living, breathing ecosystems, not just math problems on a page.
It really is. The math is perfect, clean, and symmetrical on paper, but the real world with its wars, its droughts, and its panicked speculators always throws a wrench in it. Think about that dynamic as you continue your prep. The exam tests the clean math, but understanding the messy reality is what makes the concepts stick. Keep drilling those formulas. Keep visualizing Fred staring at his silos and Pete sweating over his alpacas, and you are going to absolutely crush this section of the exam. Keep grinding. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.